this is how we close our show this week. Thanks to our journalists, Heather Watson, Erica Butler, Jules Bugiel, Ryan Funk, and Ryan Gillespie-Wilson. Our national editors are Victoria Fenner and Conrad Fox. Viewpoints is brought to you by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Local Journalism Initiative. I'm Boris Chassagne, your host and producer. Thanks to you for keeping us company this week, and until the next, ciao.
Now.
This is step one, but to hear the judge from the bench say that in his 40 years as a judge, he has never seen something so blatantly unconstitutional sets the tone for the seriousness of this effort.
A federal judge in Seattle blocks President Trump's executive order ending birthright citizenship. The case is one of five lawsuits brought by 24 states, cities, and immigrant rights groups across the country. We'll speak with one of those groups, Make the Road New York.
We're suing because we believe firmly that no president should be allowed to turn the Constitution on or off, particularly when it comes to deciding who gets to be a citizen or not in this country.
Then, as President Trump renews his attack on civil rights and diversity, equity, and inclusion, we'll look at the posthumous pardoning of Black nationalist leader Marcus Garvey, one of President Biden's final acts in office.
Look for me in a world when there is storm. Look for me all around you. For with God's grace, I shall come back with countless millions of black men and women who have died in America, those who have died in the West Indies, and those who have died in Africa, to aid you in the fight for liberty, freedom, and life.
And finally, with Britain's foreign minister in Egypt, we'll get the latest on the jailed Egyptian writer and activist Alaa Abdel Fattah from his former cellmate, Australian journalist Peter Gresty. He was arrested on terrorism charges while working for Al Jazeera. His piece is called I Owe Alaa Abdel Fattah My Life, which is why I'm going on a hunger strike to help free him. We'll speak to him in London. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Trump administration's launched what it's calling the largest mass deportation operation in U.S. history, arresting 538 undocumented immigrants and deporting hundreds of others since Trump took the oath of office Monday. Trump's so-called border czar, Tom Homan, says the raids are aimed at sanctuary cities whose leaders refuse to comply with Trump's mass deportation plans. On Thursday, ICE agents raided a seafood depot in Newark, New Jersey, taking three people into custody, including a military veteran. Newark Mayor Ross Baraka condemned the warrantless immigration raids, writing, quote, "The egregious act is in plain violation of the Fourth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. Newark will not stand by idly while people are being unlawfully terrorized," the mayor said. The New York Times reports Trump has given ICE officials the power to quickly deport asylum seekers who were allowed into the U.S. temporarily under Biden-era programs. The policy change could affect more than a million people who've been granted up to 2 years to remain in the U.S. under a temporary legal status known as parole. Meanwhile, a federal judge in Seattle has blocked President Trump's executive order ending the constitutional guarantee of citizenship for anyone born in the U.S. Nick Brown is Washington State Attorney General.
This is step one, but to hear the judge from the bench say that in his 40 years as a judge, he has never seen something so blatantly unconstitutional sets the tone for the seriousness of this effort. I think what the order today reinforces is that no one individual, not even the President of the United States, can simply erase what it means to amend the Constitution and the process therein.
We'll have more on Trump's war on immigrants after headlines. Recently sworn in Secretary of State Marco Rubio ordered the State Department to halt processing passports for people who indicate their sex as X on their application, stating in an email that, quote, "The policy of the United States is that an individual's sex is not changeable," unquote. The directive means trans, intersex, and non-binary people who choose the X marker will be forced to carry passports that misgender them. This comes days after Trump issued a day one executive order that asserted there are, quote, two sexes, male and female, unquote. The Biden administration allowed people to select a sex marker on their passports that reflects their gender identity starting in 2021 and issued the X marker option for passports in 2022. The Senate has confirmed John Ratcliffe as director of the Central Intelligence Agency. 21 members of the Democratic caucus joined Republicans in Thursday's 74-25 vote, making Ratcliffe the second nominee approved in Trump's new term. Rubio was the first. The Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee has advanced the nominations of fracking executive Chris Wright for Energy Secretary, and North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum to lead the Interior Department. Both Wright and Burgum have pledged to carry out Trump's campaign pledge to drill, baby, drill to boost oil and gas production. Meanwhile, the Senate's Environment and Public Works Committee has advanced Lee Zeldin's nomination to lead the Environmental Protection Agency. Zeldin is a former Republican Congress member who earned a score of 14 out of 100 from the League of Conservation Voters for voting against critical environmental protections and clean energy job investments. Multiple news outlets are reporting Trump's nominee to lead the Pentagon, Pete Hegseth, told Senator Elizabeth Warren that he paid $50,000 to a woman who accused him of sexually assaulting her in 2017. Hegseth reportedly made the disclosure in written responses to questions from senators as part of the vetting process for his confirmation. The news comes after Hegseth's ex-wife provided the FBI with a new statement about Hegseth's alcohol abuse. CNN reports Samantha Hegseth told agents carrying out a background check, quote, "He drinks more often than he doesn't," unquote. Hegseth's divorce settlement with a second wife includes a non-disparagement clause barring her from making negative public comments about her ex-husband, Hegseth. In more Pentagon news, Trump officials are reportedly making plans to eliminate a military office created last year in 2023 that focuses on reducing civilian deaths in war zones. President Trump demanded lower oil prices and a worldwide drop in interest rates as he remotely addressed the World Economic Forum in Davos Thursday. Trump also slammed European trade policies and regulations as he vowed to impose tariffs on companies that produce goods outside the U.S.
"Come make your product in America, and we will give you among the lowest taxes of any nation on earth. We're bringing them down very substantially, even from the original Trump tax cuts. But if you don't make your product in America, which is your prerogative, then very simply, you will have to pay a tariff."
On Wednesday, President Trump made his first call to a foreign leader since returning to office, speaking with Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Saudi media reported after the call, bin Salman vowed to invest $600 billion in the U.S. over the next 4 years. Trump suggested he could make his first overseas trip as president to Saudi Arabia, as he did in his first term. Trump is expected to push hard for a normalization agreement between Saudi Arabia and Israel. Saudi Arabia has said Palestinian statehood is a condition of normalization with Israel. On Thursday, the White House announced Trump also spoke to Salvadoran President Nayib Bukele. News of the call, along with Trump's announcement he's considering establishing a national digital asset stockpile, sent Bitcoin's price soaring past $106,000. Bukele is a major proponent of cryptocurrency, adopting Bitcoin as legal tender in 2021. In the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces shot and wounded a 65-year-old Palestinian man as they carried out a fourth day of raids on the Jenin refugee camp. According to the UN, Israeli forces have killed 34 Palestinians, including 6 children, across the West Bank since the start of the new year. In Gaza, leaders of Hamas say they'll provide the names of 4 more Israeli hostages scheduled for release. Under the terms of the ceasefire deal, Israel will free a group of Palestinian captives during a prisoner exchange on Saturday. The UN reports 4,800 trucks carrying humanitarian aid have arrived since the ceasefire took effect last Sunday. The desperately needed surge of supplies comes just days before a new Israeli law is set to take effect January 28th, banning the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, known as UNRWA, from operating in Israel or the territories it occupies. The move is likely to dramatically increase Gaza's suffering as the UN's main humanitarian operation crumbles without an alternative in place to serve Gaza's more than 2 million people. UNRWA reports Israeli attacks since October 2023 have killed 272 of its members. On Wednesday, Palestinians surveyed damage to UN facilities in Rafah, where Israeli attacks left UNRWA warehouses and delivery vehicles in tatters.
This place has nothing to do with the resistance or anything else. This place used to feed us. These are all the warehouses of UNRWA that used to assist the Palestinian people. We all used to get our flour from it, and so on. And as you can see, look at how the destruction is everywhere.
Iraq's parliament has approved new legislation that would lower the minimum age of marriage below 18, a shift rights groups say will legalize child rape in Iraq. The new law gives religious authorities more power over matters of marriage, divorce, and inheritance, further limiting legal protections for Iraqi women and allowing for girls as young as 9 years old to be married off. Child marriage is already a common practice in Iraq. A 2023 UN survey found 28% of Iraqi girls were forced into marriage before they turned 18. The International Criminal Court has issued arrest warrants for 2 Taliban leaders for gender-based crimes against women and girls in Afghanistan. ICC Chief Prosecutor Karim Khan laid out the case against the 2 men, Hibatullah Akhundzadeh and Supreme Leader of the Taliban, and Hakim Haqqani, Chief Justice of what the Taliban calls the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan.
My office has concluded that these 2 Afghan nationals are criminally responsible for persecuting Afghan girls and women, as well as persons whom the Taliban perceived are not conforming with their ideological expectations of gender identity or expression, and persons whom the Taliban perceived as allies of girls and women.
That's ICC Chief Prosecutor Karim Khan. Amazon's announced it's closing 7 facilities in Quebec, Canada, and laying off 1,700 workers. The move comes less than a year after workers at one of the warehouses unionized and were working towards their first contract. In Serbia, students and workers across all sectors have launched a general strike today, the culmination of 3 months of mass student-led demonstrations. The protest movement started in response to the collapse of a roof at a train station in November in the northern city of Novi Sad, which killed 15 people. Serbs have since taken to the streets to call out government corruption and inefficiency. Serbian President Aleksandar Vučić has accused the protesters of being foreign agents, while some students have said they've been doxxed and harassed by authorities. This is student activist Luka Stojaković speaking from a protest in Belgrade last month.
The problem of our society is that corruption has entered every pore of society, and that it is the cause of everything that is happening, from the fall of the canopy and the death of 15 people to everything that happened to us before that.
The Sackler family and Purdue Pharma, maker of OxyContin, have increased their settlement offer to $7.4 billion amidst ongoing legal negotiations with states, tribes, and local governments that sued Purdue for creating and fueling the deadly opioid epidemic. Under the new deal, Sackler family members would not receive immunity from future opioid lawsuits, a condition they previously insisted on but was rejected by the Supreme Court in June. Instead, a portion of the settlement money will be set aside to cover the cost of any future litigation against the Sacklers. All the states, cities, counties, and territories involved in the case must agree to the terms of the new deal before it can move forward. A committee at Northwestern University has found there was no reason for Northwestern to have suspended Professor Stephen Thrasher, chair of social justice reporting at the Medill School of Journalism, last September. Dr. Thrasher, along with fellow professors, formed a defense line to protect students demonstrating for Palestinian rights last spring. He was assaulted by police and later was called out by name during a congressional hearing about campus protests. But even as the committee exonerated Thrasher, Northwestern has opened another disciplinary proceeding against him. To see our interviews with Dr. Thrasher, go to democracynow.org. And the Palestinian-Israeli film No Other Land has been nominated for an Academy Award for Best Documentary. The film takes an unflinching look at Israel's mass expulsion of Palestinians living in Masafariata in the occupied West Bank. Despite its critical and festival success, No Other Land has not been able to find distribution in the United States. To see our interviews with co-director Yuval Abraham, go to democracynow.org. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As the Trump administration launches what it's calling the largest deportation campaign in U.S. history, we look now at how immigrant communities and advocates are fighting back. A federal judge in Seattle has temporarily blocked President Trump's executive order aiming to end birthright citizenship for the children of undocumented parents and non-permanent residents in the United States. Thursday's ruling by U.S. District Court Judge John Koinour is the first in what's expected to be a long legal battle against Trump's anti-immigrant agenda. The judge described the order as, quote, blatantly unconstitutional. He went on to challenge Trump's lawyers, saying, quote, frankly, I have difficulty understanding how a member of the bar would state unequivocally that this is a constitutional order. It just boggles my mind, the judge said. The case was brought by a coalition of states, Washington, Arizona, Illinois, and Oregon. Washington State or Attorney General Nick Brown spoke outside the U.S. District Court after the hearing.
This is step one, but to hear the judge from the bench say that in his 40 years as a judge, he has never seen something so blatantly unconstitutional sets the tone for the seriousness of this effort. I think what the order today reinforces is that no one individual, not even the President of the United States, can simply erase what it means to amend the Constitution and the process therein.
There were several other lawsuits filed against the executive order, which was one of dozens signed by President Trump in the Oval Office shortly after he was inaugurated on Monday.
This next order relates to the definition of birthright citizenship under the 14th Amendment of the United States.
Yeah, that's a good one. Birthright. That's a big one.
What about that one in the court? That one is likely to be challenged.
Could be. We think we have good grounds, but you could be right. I mean, you'll find out. It's ridiculous. We're the only country in the world that does this with birthright, as you know. And it's just absolutely ridiculous. But, you know, we'll see. We have very good grounds.
Sir,
people have wanted to do this for decades.
This all comes as Trump's federal immigration agents have already arrested over 500 undocumented people and deported hundreds more since Monday. Trump's so-called border czar, Tom Homan, says the raids are aimed at sanctuary cities whose leaders refuse to comply with Trump's mass deportation plans. On Thursday, ICE agents raided a seafood depot in Newark, New Jersey, taking three people into custody, including a military veteran. Newark Mayor Ross Baraka condemned the warrantless immigration raids, writing, quote, "This egregious act is in plain violation of the Fourth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. Newark will not stand by idly while people are being unlawfully terrorized," unquote. For more, we're joined by two guests. Here in New York, Harold Solis is the legal director of Make the Road New York. His organization, along with the ACLU and others, also filed a lawsuit against Trump's executive order ending birthright citizenship. And in Paris, we're joined by Mei Nye, Lung Family Professor of Asian American Studies and Professor of History at Columbia University, author of several books, including the award-winning Impossible Subjects, Illegal Aliens, and the Making of Modern America. Her new piece for the London School of Economics blog is titled Trump's Executive Order to Curtail Birthright Citizenship is part of the long history of alien citizenship in the U.S. Professor Nye, we're going to begin with you. Can you respond to the judge's ruling in Seattle, Washington, absolutely excoriating the lawyers and also just going after that executive order, saying an executive order cannot overturn the Constitution? Explain what happened.
Good morning, Amy. Thanks for having me. The judge is absolutely correct. It's blatantly unconstitutional. The president cannot change the Constitution. But here's the thing. When Trump says this idea has been around for a long time, it's true. It's been introduced into the Congress since the 1990s. People considered it a wacko idea. Its main theorist and architect is John Eastman, who we know more recently from the efforts to overturn the 2020 election, right? So what Eastman is proposing and what Trump is arguing is not actually technically overturning the 14th Amendment. They want to reinterpret one phrase in it so that they can exclude the children of undocumented immigrants from citizenship. So they don't think they're overturning it, which they know is a long road. They just want to tweak what the interpretation of jurisdiction means, who is subject to the jurisdiction of the United States.
Explain exactly the 14th Amendment and the levels of challenge. I mean, what an executive order is and what an amendment to the Constitution is and where this goes from here.
The 14th Amendment is passed after the Civil War. And this section on citizenship is aimed specifically to overturn the Dred Scott ruling, which we all know said that black people have no rights and are not citizens of this country. So after the Civil War, the Constitution was amended to make them all citizens by saying all persons born and naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and the state wherein they reside. Now, what Trump wants to do is to reinterpret the meaning of subject to the jurisdiction thereof by saying that doesn't, the undocumented migrants are not welcome here. They were not invited. So they're not part of the jurisdiction. But that's a false argument. It's long been held that only foreign diplomats are not subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. That's what we call diplomatic immunity. Now, anybody who knows anything about American life knows that everybody on American soil is subject to domestic law. An undocumented immigrant who gets a speeding ticket is subject to American law. So this is really a bogus argument, but they are hoping that they can go before the Supreme Court, which has been very favorable to Trump. And this is why we have concern, I think, to worry. The Seattle judge was absolutely correct that this is blatantly unconstitutional. It's outrageous. But we now have a court that has given the president immunity, basically unlimited immunity. This court also would not consider disqualifying him from the ballot on grounds that he's an insurrectionist. So the court is, to many people's minds, including mine, very clearly politicized and political. And this is where we have, I think, reason to worry, notwithstanding the unconstitutionality of the order.
Harold Solis, you're with Make the Road New York. You also have sued, along with the ACLU, around birthright citizenship. Explain the basis of your suit and how it relates. What happens now that the judge has struck this down, saying he's almost never seen anything like this in his decades on the bench?
Sure. Thank you, Amy, and thank you for having me on. Just as May was discussing, right, the basis of the 14th Amendment, its important history, that's all what's been animating, you know, our concern around this idea of ending or curtailing birthright citizenship. You know, I can say from the get-go that, unfortunately, this was something that we anticipated for quite some time. You know, the Trump campaign during the campaign trail and shortly after the election was already telegraphing that this was something that they were going to act on from day one. And so it was already on top of, you know, at the top of our minds, at the top of our members' minds, as something that we needed to be prepared for. And so the basis of our lawsuit is exactly this, right, that the 14th Amendment is in the Constitution and that no president, no matter what political party, right, should be allowed to revise it, to erase it, to turn it on or off based on the political winds of the day. You know, we are deeply concerned about this because it represents a Pandora's box that, if left open, if we allow any president to open it, the consequences would be devastating.
So what happens with your suit?
So our lawsuit is moving currently in New Hampshire. And there, you know, currently we are set to argue for preliminary injunctive relief in early February. And so both lawsuits are walking, you know, in tandem in some ways. The basis of our lawsuit, right, is that we have members who are going to be directly impacted by this executive order. We have families in our membership that are, you know, waiting, have been here for years, and have been deeply concerned about what this executive order could mean for them and their soon to be born children. Right. I mean, this executive order targets children who are going to be born, who otherwise would be entitled to all the protections that the Constitution affords.
So at the same time all of this happened yesterday, you also have this immigration raid in Newark, New Jersey. Can you talk about the significance of this? And the mayor of the city, Ross Baraka, fiercely critical of what took place.
I think he's right to be fiercely critical of what took place. You know, I think many of us woke up this morning to the news of what was happening there. I think we all saw reports of even U.S. citizens being impacted by the raid. This sort of, you know, escalation in enforcement is something that we've been deeply concerned about. It's something that, you know, I think sometimes in the public mind, we like to think that, you know, when we talk about immigration, it's only something that affects immigrants. But actually, right, these sorts of tactics have an impact on everybody in our communities. And so it's deeply concerning. It's great that the mayor has, you know, is standing by, you know, the laws and the policies that are in place there, and by his residents as well.
I mean, people might be surprised to know that the Trump administration has directed federal prosecutors nationwide to investigate and potentially bring criminal charges against city and state officials, presumably, you know, in sanctuary state and states and cities, who are resisting these kinds of actions, anti-immigrant actions like the raids.
Right. Yes. I mean, this is opening up a front again that he's also been telegraphing for quite some time. You know, this is another one of those moments where we have to be thoughtful about how we're thinking about these threats that are coming from the White House. You know, these laws, these local laws and policies that have been put in place throughout the country and in many jurisdictions, including here in New York City, are also grounded in constitutional principles, including the fact that both states and cities, right, cannot be forced to, you know, cannot be forced to do the federal government's job, essentially.
So you're here in New York, Make the Road New York. Explain what it is to be a sanctuary city.
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, there's no one single legal definition of what it means to be a sanctuary jurisdiction. But essentially, I think what many people agree upon is that it means being a welcoming place, right? A place where the jurisdiction is not looking to do more harm, number one, to its residents, and number two, that it is not going to dedicate its time, its resources, right, to doing something that is, as the federal government knows, is principally their responsibility. So in some ways, it's not that the jurisdiction is impeding any immigration efforts. It's simply that they're not going to go hand in hand and do the job with the federal government.
So what about the Trump administration saying they will allow ICE to conduct raids at churches, hospitals, schools? How are you preparing for this? And also explain the whole Know Your Rights movement. I'm sure Make the Road is a part of this all over the country, where people are trying to educate others, immigrant and non-immigrant, about what to do in the case of an ICE raid, an ICE agent walking on the street, an ICE agent knocking on your door, what your rights are.
Yeah. Look, I'm going to be honest with you. We're in a moment where there's a ton of fear in the community, right? We're hearing about birthright citizenship being attacked, right? And that's deeply unsettling to people who, up until last week, maybe they didn't have to worry about what their citizenship meant in this country. So we're hearing some real concerns about that. And yes, now you have this flurry of attacks and threats coming out of the White House that is sending this message that even places like hospitals, schools, churches, houses of worship might also be targets of ICE enforcement. And so understandably, people are asking questions about what this means for them and their daily lives. I'll say two things. One, yes, we are deeply concerned about this rescission of this memo that in the past has sort of governed ICE's ability to enter these sensitive locations, hospitals, schools, et cetera. But we also know that that's the reason why we have some of these local laws and policies in place, which is to give people some reassurance that they can go about their daily lives without worrying that ICE is going to show up, you know, at
and
the hospital.
And people are afraid to go to school.
I'm hearing this
people
from parents.
People are afraid to go to work.
I've been getting this question all week long. Can I send my kids to schools? Parents have enough on our minds, right, to have to be worrying about whether their kid is safe enough to be in school, where they should be paying attention, where they should be focusing on their academics, not worrying if they're going to get picked up or if someone else who works at a school is going to get picked up. This is not what schools are for. And I've been getting this question throughout the week. We've been working day and night. You know, I'm lucky to work with a team of amazing organizers, lawyers, health advocates, teachers, who for the last few months have been doing everything possible to spread the news about what are people's rights in our communities so that they can get some sense of hope and knowledge in a time that is filled with fear.
Maynai, we're going to give you the last word. You have studied this issue for decades. You're not inside the United States right now, where you usually are. But everything from birthright citizenship to the raids have begun. And the threats to officials if they try to stop these raids, and the idea that schools, churches can be raided by ICE.
I think what we're seeing this week is shock and awe. It's meant to terrorize immigrants in their communities, their families. It's meant to terrorize and make fearful elected officials, leaders of organizations. It's a big shock and awe. How much they will continue to do this remains to be seen. I think they're serious. I think we should be very worried. But it's not clear to me that they can actually deport 11 million people. It's wildly expensive and difficult to do. Can he deport 1 million people a year? Even that's difficult. But they're going to make a big show of this and terrorize our communities. And I think we have to fight on all levels, in the communities, in the courts. And the political and legal situation does not look great for us, I'm afraid, because I think the Supreme Court may very well go along with some of this, both on the 14th Amendment and on the 10th Amendment, which is the amendment that says that states and local governments cannot be forced, cannot be coerced into enforcing federal laws. So we'll see how this goes. I think we should be very concerned and pay close attention.
May Nye, professor of Asian American Studies and History at Columbia University, speaking to us today from Paris, France, and Harold Solis, legal director at Make the Road New York. Coming up, the posthumous pardoning of the Black nationalist leader Marcus Garvey. It was one of President Biden's last acts in office. Stay with us.
Marcus Garvey's words come to pass. Marcus Garvey's words come to pass. Can't get no food to eat. Can't get no money to spend. Oh. Can't get no food to eat. Can't get no money to spend. And you, hello, come little one, come, oh, let me do what I can, for you and you alone. Oh.
Marcus Garvey by Burning Spear. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Last week, President Biden made history by issuing more pardons and commutations than any president before him. Among the thousands of pardons was one that came after more than a century. Black nationalist leader Marcus Garvey received a posthumous pardon for a mail fraud conviction in 1923. Advocates and congressional leaders had pushed for Garvey's pardon for years, with supporters arguing Garvey's conviction was politically motivated and an effort to silence the Pan-African leader who spoke of racial pride. This is audio of Marcus Garvey speaking in Harlem in 1924.
The Negro is the man. We represent the new Negro. His back is not yet against the wall. We do not want his back against the wall because that would be a peculiar and desperate position. We do not want him there. It is because of this that we are asking for fair compromise. Where the Belgians have control of the Belgian Congo, which they cannot use, they have not the resources to develop nor the intelligence. The French have more territory than they can develop. There are certain parts of Africa in which they cannot live at all. So it is for you to come together and give us a United States of Africa.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
We are not going to be arrested without a country. God never intended it, and we are not going to abuse God's confidence in us as men. We are men, human beings, capable of the same acts as any other race, possessing under fair circumstances the same intelligence as any other race. Now, Africa's been sleeping, not dead, only sleeping. Today, Africa's walking around not only on her feet, but on her brains. You can enslave what was done for 300 years, the bodies of men. You can shackle the hands of men. You can shackle the feet of men. You can imprison the bodies of men, but you cannot shackle or imprison the minds of men.
Born in Jamaica in 1887, Marcus Garvey established the Universal Negro Improvement Association, an African Communities League, in 1914. In 1917, he established the headquarters of the UNIA in Harlem. Black self-reliance was central to his ideology, and he established the Black Star Line, a shipping company which raised over $600,000 before collapsing in 1922. In 1923, U.S. authorities prosecuted and convicted Garvey for mail fraud in connection with the Black Star Line. He served a two-year sentence, was then deported to Jamaica. He died in 1940 in England. For more, we go to human rights lawyer and Howard University's School of Law professor Justin Hansford. He's executive director of the Thurgood Marshall Civil Rights Center, the first American to be nominated and elected to the United Nations Permanent Forum for People of African Descent. Professor Hansford is the author of Jailing a Rainbow, The Unjust Trial and Conviction of Marcus Garvey. So, Professor Hansford, you and Howard University were instrumental in achieving this pardon in the last hours of President Biden's tenure. Tell us the story of Marcus Garvey.
Yes, good morning, Amy. This is a pleasure this morning to talk about one of my personal heroes. You know, Marcus Garvey, as you described, was one of the first anti-colonial global black leaders. He created an organization of over 6 million people. And what he did was do more than simply provide inspiration, but he also provided a blueprint for Pan-Africanism, the creation of the red, black, and green flag. You know, his words, for example, "We will emancipate ourselves from mental slavery," would later be a foundation for the lyrics of reggae music, which were quoted by Bob Marley in images and ideas sent across the globe. And, you know, the parents of Malcolm X were devout followers of Garvey. And that served as an inspiration for Malcolm X's activism and Dr. Martin Luther King. So that the echoes of his work reverberate unto today throughout the black freedom struggle. And this particular legacy is one that not enough people know about. And one of the wonderful things about obtaining this pardon is to have this conversation this morning, to have the conversation which has taken place over the past week, to be able to, in this time when black history is being suppressed all across the country in schools across the country, we have an opportunity now to talk about these ideas around entrepreneurship and, you know, self-confidence and a global lens on activism and liberation, which is especially in this time where we're facing so many threats on, with our social justice struggles being pushed into a corner. As you just heard Marcus Garvey say, we do not intend to stay in that corner. We intend to fight back. And he's a wonderful example and inspiration of what that fight back must look like going forward.
So, Professor Hansford, can you be specific on his life? Talk about the Black Star Line. Talk about what got him in legal trouble and the political underpinnings of that, what it meant for him to go to jail, and why he ended up being deported.
Yes, well, you have to think back to 1920, 1921. The context 100 years ago is we're in the midst of Jim Crow. We're having hundreds of lynchings taking place around the country. Black people are one generation removed from enslavement. And here comes Marcus Garvey with the idea to create a mode of travel and commerce that would connect the black diaspora in the Caribbean and on the African continent. Remember, at that time, every country in Africa was under colonial rule except Ethiopia. So here's this concept. Many people would use the term back to Africa. But what was meant by his rhetoric was that he wanted to allow people to return back to their spiritual roots on the continent. And in addition to that, think about the concept of independent economic commerce and being able to do for yourself. And so what took place was he created the Black Star Line, which energized the world. And it's hard to overstate, you know, how important this was and how inspirational this was. Young, you know, kids on the continent of Africa would read his speeches in his newspapers and memorize the words and, you know, run back to the rest of their community and repeat the words that they had memorized. I mean, this electrified a people around the world that were in the midst of oppression. And at the same time, this was a shipping company created to allow people to trade goods and travel. And at this time, we know that in the early 1920s, we're on the cusp of the Great Depression. It was after World War I, so there were a lot of ships available for this type of activity. And a number of factors made it very difficult to thrive economically with the shipping company as the Great Depression sparked off. But what happened was J. Edgar Hoover, we know that name as later on in his career as the head of the FBI, he would go on to create COINTELPRO and to harass Dr. Martin Luther King and the Black Panther Party. But he really got his start harassing Marcus Garvey, who we feared would be a quote-unquote Black Moses. And so he led an investigation where he targeted Garvey. The first Black FBI agent named James Wormley Jones was assigned to infiltrate Garvey's Black Star Line.
And ultimately, they brought a lawsuit arguing that the entire Black Star Line enterprise and project was just a fraud. And to use the mails to advertise for the Black Star Line was using the mails to defraud. And so they brought that case before an all-white jury in 1923 and convicted Garvey and ultimately imprisoned and deported him. And he would never return to the United States after that conviction. And I just wanted to say what made that conviction so terrible. It wasn't simply a random charge. What they did is they tried to undercut his life's work and say the very thing that inspired millions of people around the world was actually a fake and a fraud. And so it spoke to the heart of his activism and his vision and really tried to delegitimize his life's work. That's what made it so important to overturn that.
In July of 1917, the city of East St. Louis, Illinois, became the scene of one of the bloodiest race riots of the 20th century. Mobs of whites set fire to the homes of Black residents, beat, shot, and lynched men, women, and children. Marcus Garvey spoke out against the violence in an emergency meeting in Harlem, marking the expansion of his movement to include American race relations. This is a clip from Stanley Nelson's PBS American Experience documentary, Marcus Garvey, Look for Me in the Whirlwind. It's an actor reading Garvey's speech.
The whole thing, my friends, is a bloody farce. That the police and soldiers did nothing to stem the murder thirst of the mob is conclusive proof of conspiracy on the part of the civil authorities to condone the acts of the white mob against Negroes. White people are taking advantage of black men today because black men all over the world are disunited.
So that was a reading of Marcus Garvey. Explain the context, Professor Hansford.
Yes, well, what we're talking about in 1923 is shortly after the Red Summer of 1919. We're seeing lynchings happening all across the country and also... they're being framed as race riots. And in this context, there's a debate taking place as to how we should respond in our community. And Garvey and W.B. Du Bois and others were hotly debating this topic. Garvey's position was that we must stand up aggressively and be willing to assert ourselves and be willing to have a global vision, bring people together from around the world to fight back. It's very similar to, I have to say, an inspiration to what we're facing right now. We're in the very dark moment politically, and we have to think amongst ourselves, how are we going to respond? Are we going to respond with confidence? Are we going to respond with a sense of self-empowerment? Or do we feel like we have to cower and take a less aggressive approach? It was very confrontational. It was very courageous in terms of what Marcus Garvey advocated for. And, you know, that's one of the reasons that he was seen as a threat. And that's why he was targeted by the United States government because of his approach and his way of inspiring people to respond and stand up for themselves and really assert their dignity and come up with effective strategies that often demanded that we took an economic-based approach to self-empowerment.
The posthumous pardon for Marcus Garvey is and the same pardon as Ravi Ragbir, the immigrant rights leader. And I encourage people to go to democracynow.org to see our interview with Ravi after he, too, was pardoned. That came out on Sunday. But finally, Professor Hansford, I wanted to ask you about President Trump expanding his crackdown on DEI, diversity, equity and inclusion, revoking a 60-year-old executive order signed by then-President LBJ, Lyndon Baines Johnson, banning hiring discrimination, banning hiring discrimination, and talk about overall what has happened with this. DEI workers across the federal government have been suspended as of Wednesday. I mean, it is astounding what's going on. And in the next days, anyone in the federal government is encouraged to rat out others who might be working on disguised DEI issues. Have we seen anything like this before? And what's the significance of it?
Well, you'd have to go back to these periods in history we're talking about to see similar efforts from the federal government. And, you know, I would say that the important thing for us to understand right now is that the constitutional grounds for providing some way of creating inclusion in these institutions has not suddenly disappeared on the grounds of these executive orders. There's a big difference between the Supreme Court and the presidency. And so there's still a pathway forward. And this is connected to the pardon of Marcus Garvey, interestingly, because Garvey's pardon is an example of the process of seeking to repair harms of the past. Many people talk about the push for reparations. And many of these institutions, although the grounds for diversity based on simply an effort to create more inclusive communities for effectiveness purposes may be under challenge, it is still constitutional to create diversity on the grounds of repairing for past harm under the Supreme Court's jurisprudence. So there is a need for us to look back. You know, this is not just symbolic. This is not just academic. The more of our institutions need to look back and acknowledge the harms of the past, because then they can institute these programs as a way to provide remedies for the harms that they were culpable in the past. So these efforts, even though at the first glance, it would not seem that something like a posthumous pardon has particular resonance and relevance to our contemporary struggles, these are intimately connected processes, and we should take the message and use it for our fight going forward.
Justin Hansford, I want to thank you for being with us. Howard University School of Law professor, author of Jailing a Rainbow, The Unjust Trial and Conviction of Marcus Garvey. Up next, Australian journalist Peter Gresty, who was imprisoned by Egyptian authorities, now on hunger strike to free his former cellmate, the jail blogger and activist Ala Abdel Fattah. Stay with us. فإذا استهلكنا لا نحتج دعونا نعشق وطننا العك فإذا استهلكنا لا نحتج ونطص دماغنا في الحيطة فستثمر يوما شق الليطة نطص دماغنا في الحيطة فستثمر يوما شق الليطة وطننا العك Homeland at Odds by Mariam Salah. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. The family of the prominent British Egyptian political prisoner Ala Abdel Fattah is stepping up pressure on the British government to secure Ala's release from prison in Egypt. They've repeatedly called on British officials to prioritize his release above any new trade or economic deals with Egypt and to issue sanctions until Ala is free. British Foreign Secretary David Lammy was in Cairo Thursday, where he met with Egypt's foreign minister to discuss the Gaza ceasefire, Sudan, and other regional issues. Foreign Minister Lammy said on social media, "I repeated my call for the release of Ala Abdel Fattah so that he can return to his family, will continue to raise his case," he said. Ala's mother, the Egyptian-British activist, mathematician, professor Leila Swift, has now been on hunger strike for 117 days. She spoke to Democracy Now! Last month in London.
I'm hoping that my hunger strike will create a crisis for both governments. Actually, I'm pressuring both governments. I'm binational, so Andala is binational, so I consider that both governments are responsible for him.
British Foreign Secretary Lammy met with Professor Swift, Ala's mother, in November. He was questioned about Ala's case in the British Parliament last year.
It's of huge concern, and I pressed him to do more. We have continued to do that with the Egyptians. It's obviously sensitive because of the situation in Gaza, but I don't think they're under any doubt how seriously this is taken by the British system, the government, and this parliament.
Ala was due to be released from prison last September after 5 years behind bars over unfounded charges of spreading false news. Egyptian authorities have refused to count more than 2 years Ala spent in pretrial detention toward time served, meaning they won't release him until 2027. Ala has spent most of the last decade in seemingly indefinite imprisonment, separated from his family. For more, we go to London, where we're joined by Peter Gresty, the Australian journalist, professor at Macquarie University in Australia, the executive director for the Alliance for Journalist Freedom. Peter Gresty was arrested on terrorism charges in 2013 while working for Al Jazeera in Egypt. He met Ala Abdel Fattah in prison at the time. Peter was convicted and sentenced to 7 years, but released after 400 days after intense international pressure. He's now joining Ala's mother, Leila Swaif, and is on day five of a hunger strike demanding the British government pressure Egypt for the release of his friend Ala. His op-ed for The Guardian is headlined, "I owe Ala Abdel Fattah my life, which is why I'm going on a hunger strike to help free him." Let's hear from Ala Abdel Fattah in a moment. But Peter, let's begin with you. We only have a few minutes. Explain how you came to know Ala, the fact that his mother, the mathematics professor, is on her 117th day of a hunger strike in London, pressuring the British government, as they're both British-Egyptian citizens, to get Ala out of prison. Tell us who he was and how you knew him, Peter.
So Ala is an extraordinary character. I was in prison. I was in Egypt back in the end of 2013, covering the unfolding political crisis there for Al Jazeera. And I was arrested on terrorism charges. I was thrown into solitary confinement in Limantoura prison. And one of the first voices that I heard when I went in there was Ala's. I was confused. I was scared. I didn't know what on earth was going on, or even much about where I was. I didn't speak Arabic, and so I was very, very disoriented. And Ala reassured me. He explained what had happened, what his understanding was. He told me where I was. He said that I'm amongst friends. And he also gave me some of the psychological tools that I really needed to survive prison. After that period of solitary, we often walked up and down the exercise yard together, and I really got a sense of who he was, an extraordinary thinker, political thinker, and a writer. He gave me masterclasses in Egyptian political theory and history and sociology and so on. He also inspired me to write two letters that we smuggled out of prison. That really described my imprisonment as an attack on press freedom rather than as any judicial process related to anything we'd done. And that really framed the campaign that ultimately got me out. And so for all of those reasons, I quite literally owe Ala my life.
So, Peter, you were imprisoned with two other Al Jazeera colleagues, and you got out after a year. Ala was so active in the Arab Spring, in the Tahrir uprising. Why does he continue to be held, and what is the British government saying? Have they met with him in prison? It is their right, as he is a British-Egyptian citizen.
So Ala, as you said, was one of the main leaders of the uprising from 2011. He had this extraordinary respect and following amongst ordinary Egyptians. He inspired literally millions to come out and fill the streets in the protest that eventually toppled Hosni Mubarak. And I think that is why the Egyptian authorities are still keeping him there, because he is the most popular, the most recognized political prisoner in the system. And I think they fear his capacity to mobilize people. They fear his capacity to inspire. The charges, as you mentioned earlier on in your introduction, are completely bogus and false news. The British government has made strong words. They've written letters to President Sisi. We've had that meeting from David Lammy, the foreign secretary, just yesterday. And clearly, the authorities, the British, believe that they're doing all that they can. But as far as the family is concerned, that's simply not enough. Words or letters and points on agendas are simply not enough. Allah is still in there against Egypt's own laws. The foreign secretary, as far as the family is concerned, really needs to be using more robust economic tools to get Allah out. We don't know, at least as far as I'm aware, Allah hasn't had consular access. He hasn't had any visits from the embassy to date. One of the things that we were hoping for was that David Lammy would insist on a visit himself to see Allah, but that clearly didn't happen. So all in all, I think, as far as the family is concerned, it's been a rather disappointing meeting. The British government insists it is making robust representations, but as long as Allah still remains, it seems that it's just not enough.
His little boy growing up without him. His mother did visit him a few weeks ago. And Layla herself, Professor Swaif, is in the 117th day of her hunger fast, and you've now joined her?
Yeah, that's right. She's a